Welcome, everyone. Welcome, everyone. Well, I'm going to, since I'm in church, I'm going to say what I want to say. Is that okay? God is good. And all the time, God is good. And all the time, God certainly is good. We welcome you here to Dexter Avenue, King Memorial Baptist Church here. I am the pastor here, as well as our choir and members, and we welcome you here as we have an opportunity as in a season such as this to be here for the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery Bus Boycott. Let's give yourselves a hand clap for being here tonight. Now, because I'm not preaching on Sunday morning, I'm going to move and get out of the way. And so we recognize and thank God for the opportunity to host NPR today. As I see Ms. Candy Capel back there, who is the station manager for VAS, and we welcome her to come forward at this particular time. Amen.
Good evening, Montgomery. Good evening. Aren't we happy to be here this evening? Thank you so much for coming out. I'm Candy Capel. I'm the station manager for WVAS-FM, the voice of Alabama State University. We're so proud and so happy to be here this evening and to welcome you. Reverend Handy, I want to personally thank you for opening up this hallowed and blessed sanctuary to us and to host us this evening, you and the Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Church family. Thanks to all of you. Thank you for your generous hospitality. Also, we want to make sure that we thank you for your attendance. You are helping us to make history one more time on this anniversary of the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott. Thank you. This is an exciting evening, and you won't soon forget it. And now it's my honor and my privilege to introduce to you one of the most distinguished journalists of our time. Her 25-year journey in this field has included stints at ABC News, at the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and PBS. Many of us eagerly used to tune in every evening to her talk show and news show on NPR, which was titled Tell Me More, and it ran for 7 years on NPR. Now, as Tony mentioned, she's taken the helm as the weekend anchor of NPR's All Things Considered. She's intelligent, she's inquisitive, she's impassioned, and she's committed to excellence in everything that she does. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome the one and only Michelle Martin.
Thank you all so much. It is so great to be here with you, and I really mean it. As Candy told you, I'm Michelle Martin, and along with my beloved colleagues at NPR member station WVAS, I'd like to welcome you again to Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Church. We're so glad to be here with you in this place at this important moment. And yet, we are reminded that we come here in a year that's been filled with painful reminders of the worst of this country's racial history, the deaths of African Americans in police encounters, deaths that sparked anger and unrest, the killing of worshipers at a South Carolina church. Yet, many activists see 2015 as a moment where the civil rights movement is experiencing a rebirth for a new century. This anniversary, the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott, offers us a rare opportunity to look back and to look forward. We're so glad we're all here together for this important conversation. I want to go off script for just a second. We're going to talk about this later, and I'm reminded as I stand here in this beautiful place of all the names that we know and all of the names we do not know, all of the lives that have never been commemorated and will never be celebrated, but who are so important to us. So would it be okay if we just took just a moment, to think about all the lives of those whose names we do not know, but we celebrate nonetheless? Can we just have that moment? And I thank you so much. And before we begin our conversation, we are going to lift ourselves up with some inspiration from your very own Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Choir. Thank you. Maybe we can talk the choir into one more before we leave out of here. You think we can persuade them? All right. Thank you. Thank you all. And now I'd like to introduce our panelists. And of course, they need no introduction, or rather, no introduction could do them justice, but we will try. Taylor Branch is an historian and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of America in the King Years, a trilogy of books about Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights era. It took him 25 years to research and write. Taylor Branch, welcome. Your own Gwendolyn Boyd, she is the president of Alabama State University, her alma mater. Her career has been a series of firsts, including that she was one of the first black students chosen to integrate her junior high school. She's the first woman president of AESU. She was also appointed last year to President Obama's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans. Gwendolyn Boyd, we're so glad to have you. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Representing the next generation of activists, Ebony Howard is a civil rights litigator with the Southern Poverty Law Center. She's the managing attorney of the Montgomery office, the youngest managing attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center in her work. That's right. Mm-hmm. She has a particular focus on youth and schools and criminal justice issues, including her recent victory in a class action lawsuit challenging the use of chemical sprays by Birmingham police to deal with school discipline issues. Ebony Howard, we are so glad to have you with us. And last but certainly not least, a beloved friend to many of you, Robert Gretz. Served as pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church here on Montgomery when the bus boycott began in 1955. It was his first appointment as senior pastor, or pastor of any church, and along with many members of his congregation, actively supported the boycott, and he was an active member of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and not least of which, he was also a friend of Rosa Parks. Reverend Gretz, we are so glad to have you with us now. Thank you. Okay. Taylor Branch, we're going to ask you to set the table for us as you do so well. And we'd like to ask you briefly, if you could, for a man who's written three volumes about this issue. But just give us some context about what are some of the issues that led to the boycott in 1955. Just tell us a little bit about the context for all of this.
The country was in a tremendous fix over the perpetual contradiction between slavery and American freedom. You had just had the Brown decision a year before in which eight white justices had said segregation was incompatible with American freedom, but just a few months, nothing really had happened yet except that the South had risen up against the ruling. And just a few months before the bus boycott started, you had the Emmett Till lynching. In fact, the trial had already occurred and been acquitted. A young man, roughly the same age as many of the activists who would later start the sit-ins and freedom rides, born in 1940, lynched at 14 years old. And so you had this contradiction that America was idealistic and yet raw and evasive on race. And then all of a sudden, Rosa Parks wasn't the first person arrested off the buses in Montgomery. Segregation was here, but there were, I think the real thing we need to remember is that everything about the bus boycott was intensely personal, beginning with the community's reaction to her. She was a seamstress, but she was also the secretary of the local NAACP chapter. She appealed to the learned folks and to the humble folks at once. And when it happened to her, overnight, you had this reaction. You had a movement. We use the word often, but we don't really understand what it meant. Every movement starts when somebody is moved, and it grows, and it grew that very first night. So you had a movement that began to grow here and confront again the race issue that had been America's perpetual sin, and it began here to open doors that have liberated people far beyond race ever since. I think that's what America has the hardest time understanding, is that this was the beginning of freedom, not just for who would ride the buses here, but it was going to open doors for freedom for large numbers of people. And in that sense, the people in this bus boycott were leaders of all America.
All right. Well, thank you, Taylor Branch. Reverend Gretz, you're the only one on this stage who was an adult at the time of the boycott and participated. And as I said, this was your first church, your first appointment. Did you know what you were getting into?
Had no idea. I just graduated from the seminary in Columbus, Ohio in June of 1955 and had made a promise that I was going to go down and serve as a pastor to this congregation. Of course, the congregation was all black except for my family and I. And I was determined to be a good pastor. We got to know Mrs. Parks very early after we arrived there because she was the adult advisor to the NAACP Youth Council, which met in our church. So we had reason to see her quite frequently, had gotten to know her very well. And in the process of my trying to be a good pastor, I found out I was supporting a movement headed by a dear friend.
Can we acknowledge your family while you're here? Mrs. Gratz, can we just acknowledge you and your senior daughter? So thank you so much for coming as well, because we know you lived through this with us, with Reverend, and supported. So thank you both. Reverend Gerson, you know, I have to ask, I remember reading or an interview with you where you said that you had heard that somebody had been arrested and you didn't know that it was your good friend Rosa Parks until you, how did you hear about it? Could you call to say what happened or how did that happen?
Well, of course, keep in mind that I was white back then.
Duly noted.
So that when the phone calls were made to all the black pastors in Montgomery, nobody called me. They dared not trust me because I was white. And they had had this lifelong experience of being betrayed by one white person after another so that nobody would share that with me. Got a call from a friend of ours, a young black Lutheran pastor. He said, I understand somebody was arrested on one of the buses and we're supposed to have a boycott next Monday of the buses. What do you know about it? I said, I don't know, but I'll find out. I got somebody who surely will know. Called up Mrs. Parks on the phone. I understand that somebody's been arrested on one of the buses. That's right, Pastor Gratz.
And she said?
She said, that's right, Pastor Gratz. And that we were going to have a protest, a one-day protest against the buses the following Monday. That's right, Pastor Gratz. You know anything about it? Yes, Pastor Gratz. Do you know who was arrested? Yes, Pastor Gratz. Well, who was it? And there was a little silence, and this small voice said, it was me, Pastor Gratz.
Gwendolyn Boyd, what do you remember? Well, what do you remember about those days? You were just a baby.
I was a baby. So remembering the details of all that happened, but I grew up blocks from here, a native of Montgomery, and growing up in the projects and observing the segregation. The signs were there when I was growing up, colored only, white only. But it doesn't settle into your spirit until you are a little bit more mature. You just do, you did as you were told to do by the adults. Don't make any trouble. Don't, do anything that will get you into harm's way. But I think another part of growing up is understanding the defiance of the community, that we will be noted. We will stand up for what is right. We will stand up for justice and honesty and integrity and truth. And so having grown up in the heat of all of this, that if what happened here 60 years ago did not happen, then what happened 50 years ago would not have happened either. And so you lived in a community that knew that it was time, that whether or not we ordained this moment, that Montgomery was made for this moment. And that, as has already been said, Mrs. Parks was not the first, but she was the one made for the moment. Her character, her integrity, her conversations with Fred Gray, and we've been hearing this all day long. Throughout
Fred Gray, for those who are listening on our live stream, was her attorney during this period.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And a graduate of Alabama State University,
yes,
class of 1951.
Everybody's dropping some knowledge up here, right here.
And they had been strategically meeting because, as we mentioned, she was the secretary for the NAACP. So they knew that this moment would come. And so December 1st, that moment was the time that, okay, here it is, and we're going to move from here.
Ebony, I haven't forgotten about you. I just wanted to ask Taylor Branch and Reverend Gretz one more question, which is, I think I'm on firm ground when I say that for many of us, like the Black History Month calendar version is, she sat down, boycott happened, we won, yay, a year later. And all of what happened in that year, of how hard it was to keep going, and all that went into that is somehow kind of lost to the sands. Could you just give us a little bit of a sense of what it is that people actually had to do to keep the boycott going?
Well, first of all, they had to walk, walk to work for a year in rain and everything else. Not that many Black folks owned cars, so there were precious few of them. And the ones that did were often reluctant to let maids with dirty feet ride in their cars. So Black Montgomery had to overcome all of the differences that separated people there and go through all kinds. People got arrested. They got arrested for taillights. Churches were bombed. Reverend
Gratz. Wait, they got arrested for taillights. Where have I heard that before?
Yes, okay. South Carolina. There were bombings. There were tricks. The white folks put in the paper that the boycott was over, thinking that everybody would get out of it, and they had to mobilize through the churches an overnight. Dr. King claimed it was one of the only times he ever went out into the juke joints on Saturday night to say, no, don't read, don't pay any attention, it's not over. So there were constant crises like that, constant over what the policy ought to be, over how long people could last from start to finish.
Pastor Gretz, will you talk about some of what you and your family experienced and your members of your congregation experienced through this period? I understand, if I have my history right, that in fact bombs were planted at your house and that we're very fortunate that they didn't go off, or at least the largest one didn't go off.
Right. There were three bombs thrown at our house total. Two of them, the smaller ones, both exploded and did a lot of damage to the house. But the other one was made up of the 11 sticks of dynamite and a container of TNT. The demolitions people told us later that would have leveled the entire neighborhood and killed everybody around. That large bomb was thrown in our driveway, dropping down from the church, from the house down to the street. Didn't go off. It had two fuses of a type that were absolutely foolproof. You can't turn them off, you can't shut them down, you can't stop them from burning and exploding. They didn't explode. The bombers came back around with a smaller bomb, hoping to set off the big bomb, drove past the house, threw the smaller bomb into the yard of the house, and it exploded. And the force of that smaller bomb went right across the top of the large bomb, and it still didn't go off. We knew that God was in charge.
Amen.
Well, Pastor, you were kind enough to point out that you were white back then.
Yes.
So what did some of your white neighbors have to say about all this?
Well, some of the white people, the Ku Klux Klan type, were very angry at us. They wanted us out of town and yesterday, if not sooner. We were always getting phone calls and nasty letters and threats against our children and us. They vandalized the car, sliced the tires, put sugar in the gas tank, threw things at the house, and generally just kept up a barrage of whatever they could muster to chase us out of the house and out of Montgomery.
Why didn't you go?
We were here working with 50,000 Black people, standing together, walking together, standing up against the oppression that had been against these people for many years and many generations. How can you walk away from a group like that? 50,000 people together, and we were part of them.
Ebony Howard, I understand that some of this history is in part what made you want to become a lawyer. Is that true?
That's definitely true.
Tell us more.
Yeah, definitely. Like the people who came before me, I've always felt a calling to this work. I am aware of so many people who gave their lives, who sacrificed, who could have just been quiet, who could have not said anything, but then I'm also aware of the people who had to say something. And I count myself as someone who is a descendant of those people. And so from a very early age, I was very fortunate to be aware of my history and to be aware of the sacrifices that so many people made for civil rights in this country. And then I went to Howard University. Alabama State is great. Howard University is also exceptional.
I went there too.
Awesome. And while I was there, I banded with other students who we were all searching for how to continue this movement. We knew a lot about our history, but we saw so many injustices that were still happening. We saw children who were being pushed out of schools and into the criminal justice system, and we saw that the thing that they shared were that they were of color and that they were poor. We saw facilities where black men and women have been locked up and jailed, where they have very little opportunity, that their chances for positive life outcomes have been drastically slashed. And so I felt like if Dr. King and every other hero from the civil rights movement gave their life, put their life on the line, then that's the least I could do is to step up and to pursue this work. And so I've always been called, and it's what I'll always do.
Mm-hmm. Madam President Boyd, you've noted that Alabama State played a significant role in the history of the bus boycott, and couple things I wanted to ask about. Well, first, maybe Taylor Branch, set the table for us with telling about Joanne Robinson. Joanne Robinson is, again, one of those unsung heroes that we talk about, and some of the people at Alabama State and what they did to support the boycott. Tell us that story.
Well, there's considerable elbowing over credit for the beginning of the bus boycott. Mm-hmm. I think everybody deserves credit. But the fact is that before dawn lit the next day after Rosa Parks was arrested, Joanne Robinson and a group of teachers from the women's political, mostly teachers at Alabama State, sneaked onto the campus to use the Mimeo machine, back then they had a Mimeo, and printed up their own leaflet saying another woman has been arrested. Again, the context, it's not the first. But it happened to Rosa Parks, and it'll soon happen to us. And we want to call on people to stay off the buses. So, in fact, it was the women's group that first put that call out. Now, by the next morning, Edie Nixon, who the leader of the NAACP and who was a member of the Sleeping Car Porters Union, he had called Dr. King and said that he was going to have a meeting in Dr. King's church without asking him that he was going to do it. He just said, I'm going to have a meeting in your church. This church is too small for a mass meeting, but it's not too small to get the preachers together. And by that time, he had already talked to the lawyers about having a test case. Can this be the test case? So the idea of a test case and the bus boycott kind of merged, so that by the end of the next afternoon, they made up another leaflet to be distributed among the pastors. So the leaflets were going out in two different leaflets by Friday afternoon.
Well, talk to, if you just one more minute on that, if you would. I think some people might be listening to that and thinking, okay, so they mimeographed some leaflets in the university. What's the big deal? Tell me what the big deal was.
The big deal was that the governor, the white legislature, this was a state university, and the president of the university would have probably been obliged to fire all of them if it got out that this boycott started on a public campus. So this was a clandestine maneuver. In fact, Joanne Robinson, I found her out in L.A., toward the end of her life. She said she was very glad that they printed up another leaflet because it deflected some of the attention from them. Now, later on, she wanted some of that attention back, but at the time, she was just as happy that there were other ones out there because her job would have been kaput.
President Boyd, let's talk a little bit about that. You work with young people today, and a lot of people have felt that the sort of the spirit of activism has been kind of quiet in recent years, that many people have maybe moved into
positions of influence, or they're in corporations, they're interested in, you know, moving into positions and, you know, elected positions and so forth, but sort of activism itself, that they just can't imagine maybe students today or even faculty today doing what Joanne Robinson and these other women did. Now, you work with young people all the time on your campuses, and I'm thinking hopefully some of them are here. Tell me, what do you hear them saying about this?
Well, I think it's important to be very clear as we speak with this generation and as they're being educated on our college campuses, to know that this movement was strategic. It didn't just happen. And as we've already said, that there were many, many meetings. There was Claudette Colvin, who was arrested before Mrs. Parks. And, you know, she was 15 years old. She did the same thing. She refused to give up her seat. But because of the strategic movements among the NAACP, the lawyers, Fred Gray, and all of those who are involved, the Women's Political Caucus, and we again want to raise that fact that there were women who were already organized and who were already sick and tired of being sick and tired, and making sure that everybody knew what was going on and getting the information out. And when we talk about the mimeograph machine, which we had on display this afternoon at 3 o'clock at the university, because it's in the basement of my building where I currently work. But it is important for us to share with this generation that things did not just happen for them to be where they are today. And if you don't understand the struggle, you don't appreciate it and respect what people did for you to get where you are today. So we who have been a part of the struggle, who have had to do that, and who have been spat upon, and who have been called everything but a child of God, who have been told no because you're black, because you're a woman, because you're a black woman, whatever it is, we have to share with them the struggle that allows them to be where they are, so they don't get apathetic, they don't get complacent, they don't think, well, it's always been this way, and why are you all in my face talking about why I need to know my history?
Well, let's get into that, shall we? Let's get into that now that we've talked about, you know, sort of the history. Let's talk about the right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, and let's just take this opportunity to put some things out here. I mean, there are people who feel, I think some of the younger people feel, that people in our generation didn't do our job. Mm-hmm. Why are they still fighting these fights? Mm-hmm. What do you say to them?
Well, I think we all need to understand that people with ill will and evil intentions will always exist. So the struggle will always continue, and so you can't give up. But you have to have new strategies. I'm a preacher also, and we, you know, talk a lot of times that new levels, new devils. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've made a lot of progress. We've come a long way. But as you continue to rise and as continue to make progress and as you continue to go to the next level, you have to know that there's going to be a new devil. There are going to be people there who don't want you to progress, who don't want you to succeed, who don't want you to make it. So you have to garner strength from those who made it before you with fewer resources, with less opportunities. We're talking about mimeograph machines where they had to walk house to house to pass them out. Today, cell phone, Twitter, Facebook, okay. You know, in an instant, the word is out. So we have to understand the differences in trying to make people really understand how to grasp the seriousness of this situation.
Ebony, well, that goes to where I want to go next. Ebony, one of the grievances that the older generation has against the younger generation is that they don't have the patience, they don't take direction, and they aren't willing to really work in community with other people. And, you know, as our resident young person, what do you say to that?
Okay, so first what I say is that we don't have to be pitted against each other. We obviously need each other. We need our forefathers, so to speak, to help us and to teach us the lessons that they learned. I would say that in terms of where young people are today with activism, they are hurting and tired. And I'm not just talking about college students, I'm talking about people in communities, and we see them. I'm talking about people whose families are in jail and in prison. I'm talking about people who don't know how to like advocate for their kids that are in school, you know what I'm saying? And so it's very hard for those people who are enduring that kind of treatment to stop and want to have patience. What we need to get across to people is that the new devil is institutionalized, mm-hmm. right? And so we've gone from a situation in which racism is overt in the form of you can't use this water fountain to there are policies and procedures that just accidentally suspend more black kids than white kids, even though they engage in the same type of misbehavior. And so once we can all kind of get that understanding that it's not that the older generation didn't do their job, I'm sitting here. You know, I mean, there's no way that a little black girl from Louisville, Kentucky, who's a first-generation college student, would be here, right? Yes. That's not what it is. What it is that the weapons transform, and that we have to find a way to work with each other, to be patient with each other.
What do you say to those who say, look, I've been patient long enough? I mean, your groundbreaking lawsuit, your class action suit, was filed in 2010. It right. was just resolved last month.
Right.
5 years.
Yes.
Over pepper spray in the classroom, over kids mouthing off. In fact, there was one plaintiff in your case, if memory serves, who was crying because she had been picked on by another boy and wound up by a boy.
Yes.
Who wound up pepper sprayed and handcuffed because she was tearful.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Right. That was one of the plaintiffs in your case. So what do you say to people? Say, 5 years is too long. It's too long. It's taking too long. What do you say?
I say that 5 years is a very long time. I say that I understand that sentiment, but I can also tell you that when the opinion came through, it was sweet. And for my clients who see themselves as modern-day freedom fighters, for them, it was worth the wait. And it was validation that what happened to them was not okay, and that a federal court judge felt like it was not okay. What I would add to that, however, is that that community, the Birmingham community, who I hope are listening to me right now, when we filed that case, what should have happened was they should have stood up in complete and total outrage. The Board of Education, the City Council, the mayor, everyone should have stood up in complete outrage about the fact that children in schools, coincidentally Birmingham schools, which was the site of the Children's March, were being sprayed for adolescent misconduct. That did not happen.
And why didn't it?
That did not happen because Birmingham City Schools are 99% African American. 85% of the students are on free and reduced lunch. Somewhere along the way, somebody made a decision about what their worth was.
But then could not we then, is it a fair assumption to say that the people doing the pepper spraying look just like the students they're spraying?
That is
incorrect. Is that not correct?
That is also accurate.
So what do we say about that?
What we say about that is that somewhere along the way, someone made an assessment about what poor black kids are worth. And it wasn't just white people who did it. And what we have to do is to make a decision about what kind of investment we're going to have for our kids, all of our kids.
All right. Can we do a check-in? Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned that we're also having a parallel conversation. We're really glad to see all of you here, and we're so glad we're spending this time together. The conversation goes beyond this room. We're actually having a parallel conversation on Twitter, speaking of the new tools. Mm-hmm. And my colleague from WVAS, your own WVAS, Jay Holsey, is here, and he's monitoring what's going on Twitter to tell us what's happening. Jay, is there something you want to share with us? What kinds of conversations are you seeing on Twitter?
I'm seeing a lot of different conversations and retweets and so forth, but there is a question from Kayla J. Smith for Ebony Howard, who wants to know, she wants to pursue law and focus on class structure in minority groups, and she wants to know, what keeps you motivated to your calling?
Dr. King said, your self-sacrificing devotion to your purpose in life and your unwavering faith will carry you through times of difficulty. I firmly believe that myself and a lot of my colleagues, we were called to do this work. We feel as if we have been gifted or blessed or however you want to put it, whoever you pray to or talk to, with gifts that are supposed to be used towards ensuring that people who don't have a voice are able to speak. And so the way that we continue to go is we think about the things that people who came before us were up against and how they persevered, and we can do the same thing. And just like with the case in Birmingham City Schools, you can win. And when you win, that makes a huge statement. And that's what you have to stay focused on.
You know what I wanted to call on? Karen, are you here? Karen Jones is here. We were talking about this whole question of the movement today. Karen Jones is one of the people credited with starting the Black Lives Matter movement in Montgomery. And, you know, I'd like to hear from you about some of these issues. Is that okay?
Yes.
Do you want to stand up?
Yes.
So we can all see you. So thank you, Karen Jones, for joining us. Mm-hmm. Well, so Karen, you know, you've been working on a number of issues. I know you ran for city council, so it's kind of a both end. You have a both end experience. You're both working outside the system, but you're doing what a lot of other people did before when they started in the grassroots, also ran for office, didn't succeed this year. What is the thing that got you started? What was the thing that first got your attention?
When I moved back home, mm-hmm. I felt like I had returned to the Twilight Zone. Mm. I left for about 13 years and went to Duluth, Georgia, and it was very diverse. And when I came back home, I still felt like it was places that we couldn't go as blacks. It had not integrated fully this city. This city touts the birthplace of the civil rights movement, but has that Confederate seal in the middle. Mm-hmm. So the oxymoronic indication of the subtle racism is not being addressed. Ebony and I talk, and I brought about issues in the school system because I am an education advocate, primarily for special needs children. And I'm trying to find attorneys here who will take a case. When you have sixth grade black boys being illegally strip searched November the 13th, when you have boys being assaulted and girls, mm-hmm. when you go to the leaders, because I am a passionate person, I tell the truth. Because this is the birthplace of the civil rights movement. Too many shed blood, too many died for me to be quiet. And I think that the younger people feel that.
Let me ask you, though, about that. You raised a question. Stick with Karen for a minute there, because I want to hear more again from you. He just wanted to make sure that you sound perfect for our audience. So thank you. That's why he's going to hold on to the mic. There are those who argue that the issue is that there's no plan, that the energies of this movement isn't organized around a plan. When people say, what do you want me to do, there's no answer. What's the answer to that?
There is a plan. Mm-hmm. Truth is a plan. Exposing demons, that is the plan. You have to stand those demons down, look them in their face, and tell the truth. We have too many policies on the book that are antiquated, but we have leaders and we are in control, and it's very hurtful when we have leaders and we're in control on the Board of Education as blacks, and we have no help. It's very hurtful. You can understand it better if you had a white majority. Mm-hmm. When you have had a city mayoral election, and black people said we weren't ready or aren't ready for a black mayor, that's hurtful to a generation who accepted a black president. And most people in Montgomery couldn't pronounce President Obama's name, but they voted for him because he was black. And so the mindset, I think, still is what's white is right in this city. We have to change that because it's 2015, we're moving upon 2016. And when I speak, I'm bold and I speak truth, but a lot of people say, I'm too radical. And it's just truth. It's just truth because they're not ready to face truth. We're having a city parade on the 150th anniversary of the 13th Amendment, the ratification. I think that's an insult to the black community.
Okay, I want to hear more about that. You've given us a lot to think about. Anybody want to speak on that?
Well, I think
President
part
Boyd?
Of what we have to do, again, going back to the strategy of the movement that we're talking about, the 60th anniversary, is that schools like Alabama State University, Howard University, all of our schools were created so that we could have education as our major weapon. One of the things that people tend to say, if you want to hide something, and I'll have to finish it because you know what I was going to say.
No, I don't. So, I don't know what you mean. If you want to hide something.
If you want to hide something from some parts of the community, put it in a book. And that needs to go away as a stereotype of our community. We need to embrace education as our ticket to freedom, as the empowerment tool that it is. Because once I have it, you can't take it away.
Okay, but what? Okay, but what does that mean exactly? Exactly, what does that mean to embrace education?
It means that
you
can't lie to me. You can't just tell me anything and expect me to just accept it at face value. It means that if I don't agree with you or understand what you're saying, I can open the book for myself. I can do research for myself. I can find the truth for myself. But if we're not pushing education for our young people, if we're not letting them know how much power there is in that book, then we're creating the next generation that doesn't care, again, about literacy.
But you know, some people would argue that that's a forgive me,
no,
Madam
no.
President.
No.
that's a stereotype that African Americans don't value education, that they say they do value education, but that the systems, as Ebony Howard was telling us, are continually refreshed in a way that makes it very hard for them to achieve their goals. So,
I agree. Systems are there. The systems were there when I was trying to go.
So, wait a minute, please be clear. Yeah. What are you saying? Are you saying that African Americans don't value education enough? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that education is our ticket to freedom. And once we empower a generation to say that if you pay attention to the classwork, and we will be there to help you, we will push to get you to college.
But how is it possible that you have a system, if Karen is telling me accurately, that the system, the Board of Education here is majority African American, and in a number of other major cities, they are majority African American running these school systems. How is it that they are still so lacking?
Finances. If you look at the financial support that school system gets here in Montgomery versus some other school systems, and in most urban cities, you'll see that.
Okay.
That the cost per student is much lower in urban areas. And so our students, our children, don't get the maximum benefit that they need. They don't have the tools they need, the computers in the classroom, the smart boards, e-books, all the things that this generation needs to be able to competently move forward. Our children are lacking. And so it's a matter of finances also.
Do you want to weigh in on this,
yeah,
Ebony
I
Howard?
Yeah, I do. So I think that it's true that it's a matter of finances, but I also think it's a matter of how young people of color, particularly young people of color who come from lower ends of the social economic ladder, are viewed in this country. Our work at SPLC and the time that I've worked at SPLC, I have encountered people who think that kids who live in Montgomery or in Birmingham are thugs. They are not adolescents, they are not girls, they are not boys, they are pre-criminals and pre-welfare queens. And what I have seen is that the kids don't have the opportunity to have an adolescence. And I have talked to kids who, when I met them in school, because they had been maced, And then a year later, I saw them in the juvenile justice facility. And then another year later, I saw them in a jail because they were charged as an adult at the age of 16 or 17 years old. I've literally watched the light drain from a child's eyes. It's more than just resources. I completely agree that it is resources, but there is a assessment about what they can be. And we tell them from a very young age that they are to be feared, that they are to be scared, and it's a long history in this country. Racism is woven within our fabric. And there was a time in the 1990s when criminologists said that, well, they predicted that young boys of color would go out and commit lots of crime. It's called the super predator theory, that they would go into urban areas, into suburban areas, they would go into the rural heartland, and they would rape and they would murder. And then as a result, government systems created all kinds of laws to respond to this so-called theory. And then so that's how you get zero tolerance policies in schools. That's how you get laws that permit kids as young as 14 years old to be charged as adults. The problem with that, though, is that it never actually happened. Juvenile crime went on the decline in this country. And the result is, though, is that generations of children have been treated like criminals because they're black and poor.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you what you should, Taylor Branson, I'm going to come to you. I'm going to be asking you to be talking, thinking about and sharing with us what are your thoughts about what we should be doing
sure.
about that. Because I think a lot of people want to hear your views on that. Taylor Branch, thoughts?
I just wanted to, what she said about the 1990s also happened in the 1890s, when the very foundations of social science in the United States were grounded in assessments of the black threat after the Civil War and inherent notions of criminality. And this was not at the University of Alabama. This is at Yale and Harvard. And Johns Hopkins, in my hometown of Baltimore, its social science departments were literally created on that. In fact, there were arguments. One school of thought was that black people were so destined for a life of crime that they were going to become extinct. That they weren't. That was the conservative view, and the liberal view is that we need to take care of them. They're like children. So this is not new. This is.
Do you think that attitude still exists, Taylor Branch? That black people need to be contained somehow. Do you think that attitude still exists? I do want to note that in addition to being an historian, you're also a journalist.
I think it's the underpinning of gridlock. It's the underpinning of our politics. You cannot understand politics unless you understand all the subtle messages that underlie the structure of partisan politics in the United States. Race is the only power in the history of this country that had the power to turn every Southern white person from a Democrat into a Republican in a generation.
Not everyone. Has there ever been a moment in history, Taylor Branch, where that attitude, what are some of the key points where that attitude changed? I mean, I think, let's just face it, a few people thought that having an African-American president would somehow change these attitudes. And I think the evidence suggests that it has not.
No.
For many people. Has there ever been a moment in our history where that attitude changed, where people...
Where the fundamental attitude?
Yeah.
I would say no. I think there have been times when there were openings, but what happens when there are openings, like 1965, 50 years ago, was a pretty amazing year. You had the President of the United States saying that black people in Selma were leaders for all Americans. So it was that Concord and Lexington, so it was a century ago at Appomattox, and so it was last week in Selma. He said that the leaders of the Selma March were the leaders for all America, you know, in the icons of all American history. They were the leaders of freedom. But within that year, people turned around and said, no, black people are not the leaders. They're still the problem, and we're still the doctor.
What moment are we in now?
I think that we're in a period of percolation, trying to get out of a 50-year cycle of denying the promise of the 1960s the same way we undermined the promise of the 1860s. that history goes in cycles, but it doesn't happen automatically. It depends on people, young people like this, stepping out there. You know, in this basement, the very first decision that the bus boycott people made, the leaders, when Nixon got them together, was that there was a motion to have a bus boycott and have the people walk, but to have the leaders that were sitting in there be anonymous in secret because they were scared to do it. And that motion was voted down. And that was key because people said, you have got to get out there and take exposure. These people are going to be walking to work. We have to be out there with them. And that very night, Dr. King also said, on Monday night, he said, we are going to be wrestling with very deep concepts. We are at the forefront of American history. Look, justice is love correcting that which would work against love. He's talking about very sophisticated ideas in this thing, and people are jumping up and down saying, that's right, we are leaders. So, and that they had to create a drama. This is a very, very mature, I think some of the biggest debates and most profound debates toward the middle of the civil rights movement were saying, we are leaders for the whole country, and it's an enormous burden. And a lot of people said, well, it's not fair. We're the ones that are being injured. Why should we have to assume more burdens to lead the country out of this? And there is no answer to that except to say, if we don't do it, who's going to do it?
Mm-hmm. All right. Pastor Gretz, there's a question for you from the audience. Someone wants to know, how do I, as I mentioned, you were kind enough to point out that you're white, and someone else wants to know, how do I, as a white person, work towards civil rights without falling into white savior mindset?
Oh, my. What's the next question?
Everybody's on the spot today.
That's right. Well, you know, Booker T. Washington used to say, we have to let down our buckets where we are. Mm. Now, the way I understand that is you start where you are, and you look around and see what the situation is, and then you begin to ask yourself, what can I do about it? What can I do to help this situation become improved? Oftentimes, it'll be some very minor thing, just a minor change in a relationship, even with a member of the family, or a minor request to help out at a school someplace with teaching children who would come by after hours and just be taught what they missed during the regular hours. There are so many little things that we can do at just putting our buckets down where they are and then doing something about it. I'll bring my family into this. Our oldest daughter, oops, I wasn't supposed to say that.
Senior daughter.
My senior daughter returned to Montgomery just about a year ago. She has been here a total of less than a year. Already she's involved in probably half a dozen or more organizations that each is trying to make some positive changes in the history of Montgomery, Alabama. She's doing something. She didn't wait for anybody else to tell her. And I admire her for that. We can all do that.
Thank you. Here's another question. Someone writes, civil rights in the past have been successful because they focused on a few key issues like ending segregation and the right to vote. So this goes back to a question I asked earlier. So what are the key issues? Are there key issues? And Karen, I'm gonna put you on the spot too and ask you this question. Emily, I'm gonna ask you this. Is there a focus? Should there be a focus?
Yeah, so the way that the civil rights movement, as I have studied it, and you obviously know way more about it, Mr. Branch, but, you know, the issue of segregation and the civil rights movement led into other groups feeling empowered to stand up and to fight oppression. And that's very much what I see happening now. Right, and so right now you have the issue of mass incarceration. You have education issues that are plaguing kids of color. You obviously have LGBT issues, and so like there are an array of things that are happening right now. And I think that in 20, 30 years, we are going to look back on this time as like a resurgence of the civil rights movement, as a golden era. For me, the issues that I see as the most important are the way that people of color, starting with kids of color, are being pushed into the criminal justice system. and the lack of opportunity to re-enter society and to be productive citizens. And as Michelle Alexander has said, it's a new form of Jim Crow. And I think that as we grow, you see that in the education system, you see it with over-policing in our streets, you see it with the way that prisons are ran by private companies, you see it in deplorable conditions that are in prisons, and it's something that is getting more and more attention, and you know it's something big when President Obama says that it is.
Karen, do you want to speak on that? What questions, what issues do you think, Tony's going to bring the mic to you. What issues do you think that people should be focusing on, briefly, if you will?
Policies and procedures, and understanding what policy is. Our Constitution, Alabama's Constitution, is still racial. It is the longest in the entire world. Nobody is focusing on policy, which puts us back, you know.
Can I put you on the spot, though? That is a criticism that many people who, I'll own it, of my generation have of the next generation, is that they don't have the patience to focus on policy. They've focused on Twitter, once they've gotten their story out on Twitter, that's the end of it. What do you say to that?
I think you're asking the wrong people, because I focus on policy. Mm-hmm. And whenever I go before boards or committees and councilmen, I take the law to show them how racist this is, how backwards this is, and how they are actually not abiding by their own laws. Mm-hmm. And because nobody reads, it's not just black people. It's white people, that's and true, especially elected officials who have that white supremacist thinking. If you look at our Metropolitan Planning Organization, we have 17 voting members and only 4 are black. They included Autauga and Elmore counties, which you didn't include Lowndes County, which brings the population back up, the white population back up. Nobody is looking into how racial that is and how we're being underrepresented on the transit system. In Montgomery, we should have the flagship public transportation system of the world, and we don't. Mm.
Thank you. So Karen's saying focus on the stuff that seems boring but isn't. And here's another question from the audience. During the bus boycott, many sacrifices had to be made to advance the movement, and the questioner wants to ask what sacrifices should be made by us today to advance justice. Who wants to take that question? President Boyd, do you want to take that?
Well, I agree that there were a lot of sacrifices made because people had to commit to not be comfortable, to not ride the bus, to walk to work, to walk to church, to walk to shop. I remember walking to the grocery store and back home, which was not always a very close. And so we're not willing to be uncomfortable. And,
do you think that's true? I was going to ask you, President Boyd, but yeah. I wanted to make sure we were still friends before I put you on the spot again.
No, there are those who
argue that that is really part of the fundamental problem, that people who got comfortable and who got into positions of authority, institutional positions, lost their appetite for thinking about other people and got more addicted to their comfort than they did to justice.
Exactly.
Do you think that that's a fair criticism?
I think it's a fair criticism when a company X does something or has a product that's racially offensive, and we ask people, don't buy. Well, we come up with an excuse. Well, you know, they didn't really mean it. No, we're asking you to not buy this product because it is racially offensive. Can you just cooperate for a minute? And I think, yeah, because we don't want to be uncomfortable and we want to shop at certain places and we want to do certain things, that we're not willing to give that up for the masses and, you know, to demonstrate that we can stick together for a purpose, for a cause, for a reason. We can come together for this one time, as they did 60 years ago, and say, we're going to stand together, whether it means I can't buy my red bottoms, okay. You know, whatever color bottoms you wear. I can't get this kind of...
I didn't understand that.
Oh,
The ladies will explain later. Well, let me ask this question. Do you mind if I ask every folks here, overall, how do you feel, optimistic or pessimistic about the direction that we're going in? Can I see who feels optimistic? Who feels pessimistic? Optimistic?
Optimistic.
Pessimistic? What do you think? Is it about half and half? Does it seem about half and
that's
half
good.
To you? What do you think, Taylor Branch, about that?
I think that's good, because I think that we're at a turning point. And I think that we're at in a trough and a turning point. And one thing I always say is, goodness gracious, if they could be hopeful during the bus boycott when they were executing people for stealing $2.95. You know, Dr. King held a press conference for the... surely we can figure out ways to be optimistic now. The one advice that has stuck with me the longest comes from Diane Nash. I know a lot of you know Diane Nash, but she said that the hardest thing in the movement is, after all your arguments and you stay up all night on your principles and your drama and your strategy, you have to be willing to be exposed for those principles, and you got to be willing to be uncomfortable for it. And she said that looking back on it, every day in the movement for her was like her wedding day, in the sense that her knees were shaking. And she knew she was taking a step that was going to define her, but she didn't know how it was going to come out. And she said, if I didn't feel like that, I felt I wasn't doing my job. And I think a lot of us are more comfortable having our righteous idea and throwing it over the wall, which doesn't really expose us the way Diane Nash says you have to if you want to build a movement.
You're saying you feel optimistic, Ebony Howard. Tell me why.
I do. And trying to build off of what Mr. Branch just said, I think that one of the reasons why you see the Black Lives Matter movement happening is because there are people who don't have anywhere to be comfortable. Like, they don't have a space to hide. They don't have any other choice but to stand up because children are dying. Like, I have a son. He's 2 years old. He's a little black boy. I'm educated. His father's educated. I worry about what life is gonna be like for Jackson. I don't know that there's anything that I can tell him that will prevent a police officer from shooting him when he's 16, 17 years old because he looks scary. And so for me, I don't have a place of comfort to go to. My husband, he doesn't have a place of comfort to go to. We don't have any other choice but to act, because it's life and death for us at this point. And out of that fear, out of that very uncomfortable place, for me comes hope, because that means that if I feel that way, then other people have to feel that way, and that means that we are ready to move. There's a lot of criticism of my generation and the generation just below me about social media, about Twitter and Facebook.
I don't think it's about that, forgive me. I think it's a question of sustainability. It's just like people looked at the Occupy movement, for those who are familiar with that, and raised important issues about social inequality and about economic inequality, and don't seem to have been able to have anything to show for it. Mm-hmm. What's the plan that people can then, where's the movement as a result of that movement, right?
And so,
what's the result?
Right.
That's
and
the
so
question.
This is what I would say about social media. This is what social media can show. There are people who don't watch CNN. There are people who do not watch mainstream, like, anything. And the way that they find out
don't hurt
about
my feelings now.
I'm sorry. If it makes you feel better, I would listen to you all through college.
Thank you.
The way that they learn about things are off of Facebook. And the way that they express their frustrations are through Facebook and through Twitter. I think that it's like during the civil rights movement. How did the world learn about the horrible things that were happening in Montgomery, that were happening in, you know, cities across the South? News media came down, right? And so what we have now is we have people who are recording with their cell phones and posting it on Facebook. We have people who are, you know, able to actually follow a police officer and track him murdering a boy in cold blood. That is an incredibly powerful tool that we should not discount. In terms of if there is a plan, I agree, there is a plan. It's just that the plan doesn't look how we think that it should look based off of our history. Mm-hmm. I think that it's taking time. I think that people are using social media to mobilize each other, that they are using social media to educate people, and I think that it is happening on the ground locally. But if we're looking for a charismatic leader to pop up, like a Dr. King, perhaps that's not what we're gonna get. But we need to be happy with what we get so we can make some change.
All right. We're going to take another minute to check in with our conversation that's happening on social media. And while we're doing that, I'm gonna ask each of you to be thinking about what it is that you want to conclude with. And I promised Taylor Branch, when I spoke with him about the anniversary of the 16th Street bombing, I asked him to give us 2 points that we should be thinking about, and I only gave him time to give me one. Mm-hmm. So I promise that all these years later, I'm going to give you time to make your point, to finish your sentence. So, Jay Holsey, our colleague from WVAS, what else is happening on Twitter? You've been following the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag BusBoycott60. What are their thoughts and ideas that people sharing with us?
Jason Mann has a question. Does reverence for past leaders lead to unrealistic standards for current ones?
Mm-hmm. Taylor, do you want to take that?
Yes. I think that's pretty easy. I mean, how many people here are younger than 26?
Oh, kidding.
Dr. King was 26 on the night of the bus boycott.
Let me see those hands again. Who's younger
so
than 26?
You are all Dr. King's age or younger. He was only 26 when he made all these speeches. So it's not like Moses descended down here with a big beard. But that's what a lot of people think.
Anything else, Jay? Any other interesting ideas? I'm going to look for one more. That preachers were prominent leaders during the bus boycott. Why is there an absence of clergy leadership in the 21st century struggle? Is that... thoughts about that?
I think that it's...
Do you think... Pastor, did you want to speak on that?
I was going to say I should speak on that one. One of the sidelines that brings up is that regularly in the meetings of the board of the Montgomery Improvement Association, Dr. King would stand before us and say to us, some of us in this room are going to die. If you can't deal with that, you shouldn't be here. You should leave. Nobody ever left. I find it difficult to believe that in a comparable meeting of clergy today, when someone would pose that question to us and that possibility, I doubt if we'd have the same response. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're ready to make that total commitment and total sacrifice as was the case in the people of 60 years ago.
Why is that?
I think probably because we're focusing more on ourselves than the community.
Yeah.
And it's the old problem of sin. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that movement here in Montgomery was a spiritual movement at its base. It was the people of God putting into practice their understanding of what God meant for their lives to be like. In some ways, I like to say that in Montgomery, it was black Christians teaching white Christians how to be Christian.
Who's teaching all of us how to be Christians now?
I'm afraid certain characters on television and other places similar to that.
Well,
what did you do with that?
I'm going to, Jay, do you have anything else for us? Any other thoughts from Twitter you want to share before we turn to our final thoughts?
Well, Alejandro Grizar says, we are in a period of economic and cultural segregation. The poor whites against the poor blacks, against the poor immigrants. Mm-hmm.
Taylor, do you want to give a thought to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always the period in history when race is used to divide, to keep people apart. And that feeds a cynical age when what we really need is, as Pastor Gratt said, we need the balm in Gilead that comes from a spiritual movement, but we also need the we the people can do anything that comes from our political heritage. And the genius of this movement was that it appealed to both of them. You know, equal souls and equal votes, take your pick. We can address these problems together. And that optimism is goes against the grain of the country. So you've got to do something dramatic to restore that optimism in a cynical era when you've got people saying the only thing that keeps you safe is taking your Kalashnikov into Starbucks, you know, that you've got to have a gun. Mm-hmm. And so it's a hard thing to change the spirit of the country, but that's what this movement did. It's really remarkable.
Give us our final thought, Taylor Branch, if you would. I promised I'd let you finish your sentence this time. So give us a final thought.
Church, it was about the church bombing when we were talking, and what I wanted to say was that as grim as the church bombing was, that the very next morning, Diane Nash had already completed her plan for how to respond to the church bombing, that she felt so responsible for it because she had been instrumental in getting Dr. King to let young people march out of that same church that was bombed in the spring, which was a great turning point in the movement. And by the next morning, to answer this, she drew up a plan to immobilize Alabama until it gave black people the right to vote, and she presented it to Dr. King. And it was the blueprint for Selma. It's the really tough moments when ingenuity and faith can have the greatest effect, when she had something like that. Now, she went to Dr. King and she said, Diane, we can't do that. We've got a civil rights bill before Congress. We can't tell them we changed our mind. Now we just want to do voting rights. And he said, and she said, well, we can do both of them, and I'm going to be on you until you do this. And people said that she got on Dr. King the way the leeches got on Humphrey Bogart in The African Queen and told him that he had to do that. But that's great things come out of great crises, and we've got a great crisis now. We have to make sure that inventive, brave people like that are supported, and I think we've got a lot of them around here.
All right. Taylor Branch, author of America in the King Years, the Pulitzer Prize winner, esteemed journalist, thank you so much for being with us. Madam President, we're going to have a brief closing thought from you, and then, Reverend Doctor, you're going to give us a benediction a little later as well, so we're going to hear from you again, but give a brief closing thought, if you would.
It takes courage to change, and I think part of what we have to do is stay focused on education. I'm college president and educated, and I think if we allow ourselves to be distracted by the enemy that says, you know, education is not important, then we're going down a dangerous road. I believe that when we allow our children to be able to dream, to say that I want to be an astronaut, I want to be an engineer, it allows them to be optimistic for their future. Yes, there are people out there who want to hurt them. Yes, there are people out there who are going to hurt them. But as long as the dream lives within inside of them that says, no matter how hard you try to hurt me, I'm still going to be whatever it is that's at the end of that sentence. We've got to allow our children to dream, because then that gives them the courage to stand up to any enemy or foe that says, you're nothing and you're no one. Self-esteem for our young people is so important. And when that comes from the inside of you, no demon in hell, no weapon formed against you will be able to stop you.
Right.
But it comes from having a strong education.
Gwen Boyd, president of Alabama State University. Thank you. Ebony Howard, your final thought, your charge.
There's a story that says that the founder of Howard University, General Howard, when he went down south and he met with kids down there, he asked them what message would he want, would they want him to take back to people up north. And the story goes that one little boy said, tell them that we're rising. And that's how I feel about how we're going to move forward with this movement. We are rising, and I am hopeful that new innovations, new technologies, coupled with old spirit, coupled with old sacrifices, coupled with the willingness to devote everything that you have, is something that is just spreading, and that as a result, we are going to overcome injustice in a way that we're going to be talking about in 50 years. And I cannot wait to be a part of it and to see it happen.
Ebony Howard, litigator with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Thank you.
Pastor Gretz, final thought from you?
My final thoughts go back to one person that was one of the most amazing person I've ever met, Mr. E.D. Nixon. He was sort of the grandfather of the movement. And he used to say, we're not doing this for ourselves. We're doing it for the children coming on. Mm-hmm. That's got to be our focus.
All right. Bob Gretz, former pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church. Thank you so much. And thank you all for being here. Thanks to our colleagues at member station WVAS for partnering with us to make this evening possible. Thank you to the folks participating in our Twitter chat and following our live stream. I do want you to don't disappear, because we are going to go to the Legacy Center in a few minutes for a wine and chocolate reception. No wine here, chocolate, the Legacy Center. The Legacy Center. But to close us out, we have a performance from the talented Belle Monique, and she is accompanied by Wallace Coleman. Many of you already know her if you live in Montgomery. She is going to perform one of her original songs for us. It's called Get Lifted. Belle? Mm-hmm. Where'd she go?
Hello, everyone. It's an honor to do this. An honor. Get lifted. I wrote that. Well, my cousin wrote the hook. He tried to write the song, the whole song, and I was like, I'm not feeling the lyrics. So I had to go to a place where I went through depression, and I just had to criticize myself, and that's where the song came from. If you listen to the lyrics, I had to look at me and what I'm gonna do to change my thinking. Brady. Who say anything is possible, especially when you take the Lord everywhere you go. Believe in yourself, be you, keep the faith, it will get you through life's obstacles, victim story. There has been pain in my life, but I failed to recognize. I can see there is a soldier inside of me, and I will not let my life be consumed of holding on to things I have the power to get through. I am not perfect, but I'm good enough for peace. I know I'm worth it. My mama always told me, when you try, keep the faith, yes, and believe in yourself. Be you, keep the faith.
faith, 'cause it will get you through life's obstacles. Yes, yeah, yeah, yes. Ooh. Look, if I gotta look back, all I can say is how far God has brought me. I'm not the same. I was that girl who was scared to try and fail. And I was that girl who didn't know her value. And I was that girl who was closed up and angry inside. And now I'm that woman. I'm telling you to try. I'm telling you to try. Yes, yes. Keep holding on. Keep moving on. I know it's hard, but you gotta keep going. You gotta get up. When you try, they say anything is possible, especially when you take the Lord everywhere you go. Believe in yourself, be you, keep the faith, it will get you through life's obstacles. Yeah, yes, yes, it will. Be you, be you. Keep the faith, the faith. You just keep the faith.
Wallace Coleman, everyone. And I am Bill Lemmy. Thank you.